Hello, welcome back to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. We publish weekly in audio on all platforms and in video for some episodes, including this one. So if you're listening right now, search for our YouTube channel for the video version. To learn more about our programming to support cultural and civic renewal, please visit ciceroniansociety.org. I'm Chris Annadale, and joining me today to talk about place are Madeline Austin and Matthew Young. Let me introduce them both. Madeline Austin lives in Pittsboro, North Carolina. She is a graduate of the Virginia Military Institute and the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. When Madeline's not playing her banjo, she works as an intelligence officer in the U.S. Army Reserves. She also received the Ciceronian Society's 2025 Batchelder Award for the study of place, for which she was interviewed on episode 60 of The Sower. Matthew Young lives on a small farm in Chatham County, North Carolina, with his wife Camille and their four children. He's an assistant professor of political theory at Elon University, where he teaches courses spanning the history of political thought and constitutional law. His writing focuses on the difficulties of toleration and civil discourse. His book manuscript draws on 17th century sources to show that toleration is dependent on hope. He holds degrees in political science from Berea College and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Madeline and Matthew, welcome to The Sower.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
And I see that you're outdoors. Can you begin by telling me about where you are and why?
Yes, we're at my house. Matt lives kind of down the road, so we figured might as well be in the same spot if we're going to be having a conversation about Pittsboro and Chatham County.
That's great. It makes it at least face to face for two of us, right? If we can't be we can't have the physical proximity all together. As we had, and I saw Madeline, I saw you just a few weeks ago at the conference in Omaha. Matt meeting you for the first time. So what we wanted to do was to talk about place. And I said in prepping for this episode that we could talk both about your particular place, the specific place, everybody's place is a particular place, of Pittsboro and Chatham County, and talk also more broadly about place, which is something that I'm sure enters into the research. I know your research, Madeline, and Matthew, I expect yours as well. So why don't we begin with the intimate and the personal and the particular? Tell me about Pittsboro and about what it's like living in Chatham County, please. Either or both of you.
Sure. I can start. I moved here to Pittsboro, or just outside Pittsboro, in 2019. So this is my seventh year here. And before that, I was in Chapel Hill, which is just north of here, for a little bit. And then I grew up in Johnston County, which is two counties to the east of here. And so my blood is here in North Carolina. I believe I told you before the episode that I'm a 12th generation North Carolinian. And so I have ancestors who were farming west of here, but about an hour away in the 1690s. And so in a very real sense, North Carolina is home, and it's very hard for me to imagine living anywhere else. I did spend a lovely 4 years in Kentucky for college, but you know, I am one of those rare academic types who has a connection to place and who is able to stay relatively close to home, that I returned to North Carolina for my graduate degree and for a postdoc and now a tenure track job at Elon. So I'm incredibly blessed in that respect. My particular place, Pittsburgh is a small town. It's about 4,000 people, and it's a fairly old town in North Carolina. I think was founded in the 1700s, but has remained very small until really the last decade. And the story of the last decade has been rapid expansion and growth. And so we'll talk about that later, I'm quite sure. In a broadly rural agricultural county, we're located near several significant metropolises. We're about a half an hour south of Chapel Hill, 40 minutes south of Durham, and about 40 minutes west of Raleigh, North Carolina. And that has been part of the story of, I think, the development here in, in Chatham County. Beyond that, what is there to say? My wife and I, we have a small farm. We grow cut flowers and children, as you mentioned. Those are the two major crops. There's a minor crop of vegetables and of ducks. So we are sort of trying to revitalize actually a small property. The property we bought was in very poor repair, had been very poorly maintained. And I'm finding a lot of purpose, I think, right now, and frustration, but purpose and frustration and the sort of not just resisting the decline, not just resisting a sort of the constant decay, but trying to make headway in reversing decay, right? And so that occupies a great deal of my time when I'm not teaching. Is cleaning fence rows and tearing out old rotten posts and going over things that the previous owner of the property did very poorly and trying to do them slightly less poorly this time.
For the record, I let it be known that I painted one of their bathrooms. That's my claim to fame, my contribution. So I unfortunately don't have as clear roots really anywhere besides Brooklyn, New York. I've been on the road most of my life, but I guess it was 2022 when I was accepted into UNC, and when I visited, I met Matt, and I liked what he was about, and I wanted to ask if he knew anywhere quieter to live. I wasn't really interested in living in the hustle and bustle of Chapel Hill, even though it's very nice. It's not very hustle and bustly, but too much for me. I wanted to live kind of out there, and I was like, "You got to move to Pittsboro, North Carolina," and I did that. And as Providence would have it, the house that I live in now was available the day I looked, and it was a done deal. Yeah, I love Pittsboro a lot.
Yeah, I was wondering, Matt, thinking about what you said, I know for every farmer, for everybody who even attempts farming or frankly even gardening, there's two factors involved in your case. There's this sort of age-old struggle against entropy, where you're trying to stop the nature from reclaiming what you've sort of put in place. And you know that it wins in the long run, but you can kind of maintain and pass on in slightly better condition what you've gotten in terms of, you know, fences and garden beds and soil quality and what's growing. But is there also something going on in North Carolina, in your area, where there's of course the economic growth, the burgeoning of the population, and the Madeline, maybe relating it to some things that I know are themes in your work, the feeling of inevitability about it, that there's just going to be, if 50,000 people decide they want to live in this area, there's really no way to stop the houses from being built and the character of the land and the society that is in it from changing. Is there, for, again, a question for either or both of you, is are there both of those elements at play in trying to steward the land right now where you're at?
Oh, yeah.
Well, one thing that I often think about, Rousseau writes about the ideal size of a political community, right? And he suggests that, sort of, in the ideal, the entire citizenry could gather under an oak tree, and
He's right
then you know
about it.
he then he makes some concessions and says, maybe it could be up to the size of Geneva, and Geneva at the time was not a booming metropolis. It was a small to mid-sized town, and but he talks about in the social contract this sort of tension where, if you have a successful political community, people want to have babies and other people want to move there, right? And if you think that, so growth, he thinks, is sort of the inevitable consequence of having a desirable place to live. Other people want to share in that. And of course, we want to share that with other people. It is funny to think about, I grouse about other people moving here. But I moved here at some point, from, my home would be Johnston County, but I live in Chatham County. And then at some point, I convinced my friend to move here. And my friend isn't from North Carolina. So I think there is a sort of inevitability to it. And then the question is, like, well, is decline just necessarily baked into our successes? And Plato, I think, had things to say about this as well, or indicates this in the Republic, that if you're very successful, you might end up sort of inevitably losing something of the special character that was attached to the place being smaller.
Yeah, I think for me, that's a very wise way to go about it. yeah, it's been hard to see. For me, it's not that it's happening, especially since I'm a recent comer. It's the pace of it that is a little worrying, and I think there's more sustainable growth and less sustainable growth, and there's a lot to talk about here. Pittsburgh is developing rapidly. I don't even know how easy it was for you to get to my house with all the construction going on. But I'll sum it up, my greatest woe in the story of I think fittedness is really important in development, and having this idea of if you're building, do it well and do it according to the land. And I think what's happening is there's this cookie cutter formula that's been pressing out from Raleigh. Developers are coming and they're making the same town after the same town, and then they're moving on to the next nice one. And so I drove by and they had, taken down a whole section of woods that was kind of dear to me. And then, but they left these three magnolia trees standing. And I just prayed right there. I was like, that's a good sign. I think that the market is working. They know those are valuable. They know they can't just put those. They'll just adjust their plan a little bit. They'll keep at least the magnolias. If the pines are gone, that's fine. I'm not opposed to, you got to take down some woods to put up some houses. And the next day I came back, all three healthy magnolias felled. I pulled over and cried, to be honest.
Oh my gosh.
But that about sums it up for me. So maybe I'm more of a curmudgeon than Matt, but I doubt it.
Well, you're thinking of Rousseau and the ideal size of a polity again. One might say that a symptom, I'm sorry, a cause of the trouble we have is that we don't have genuine political community. We have an economic zone, we have actors who respond to very large scale incentives. And the rest of us are sort of swept along or swept out of the way, or if we're very unlucky, sort of bulldozed over. And again, the question of that's come up, I think, in a previous conversation with you, Madeline, of agency. How does one maintain one's sense of agency or control over one's life if there's not a political community that can somehow assert itself in favor of Chatham County, the local area, the land? Not that it has to be necessarily exclusionary and that only so many people can move here this year, but maybe I'm just projecting a bit of my own feelings about this as a rural resident, that there's a certain kind of helplessness, and it has to do with something fairly deep at the level of the nature of the American economic and political system, at least as we experience it. What are your thoughts?
Well, the idea of fittedness, I think, is very important. Just this morning, I actually had a conversation with my mother. I purchased some trees and picked them up from our local native. My wife picked them up from the local native tree nursery this morning, and I took some pictures and sent them to my family members. And my mom asked, she said, "I'm curious, why did you buy an American Snowbell instead of a Carolina Silverbell? They're two very similar trees in many ways." And my response was, "I do want a Carolina Silverbell, but this particular tree is going in a low spot in a pasture where we're planting a sort of native hedgerow. And while these two trees, they're related, they're both in the Styrax family, they both look very similar. An American Snowbell is a swampy bottomland tree, and a Carolina Silverbell is an upland tree that wants its soil a little more well drained. You'll sometimes find American Snowbell growing with its roots completely submerged. So at this spot, I need a tree that wants its roots very wet, right? And so even within 5.5 acres, there's a question of fittedness in planting trees. And we recognize, or at least we ought to recognize, and I think farming gives you this sense that plants are not interchangeable, trees are not all interchangeable, and places are not interchangeable. That the tree that I'm planting The beech tree I'm about to plant in front of my house is picked for that specific location, just like the American snowbell I'm about to plant is picked for its specific location. And I think the most corrosive thing about maybe modernity is this a sort of god of frictionless exchange, where things have to be they have to be easily replaceable. They have to be things that can just be swapped, that can be put anywhere. And of course, right, this is the thing about cookie cutter development. They're houses that have no connection to the vernacular architecture of a place.
Can't tell where you
You couldn't tell, right, where you are, because the developments that they're putting up in Maryland near you, I'm sure, look just like the developments that they're putting up in North Carolina near us. And yeah, so I think that is sort of heart of, or a big part of the problem is that the market society really incentivizes reducing any sort of friction. And in Chatham County, for there to be a Chatham County politics that is devoted to Chatham County, there has to be a sort of sense that living in Chatham County and being committed to Chatham County is slightly different than living in Orange County or in Wake County, which are neighboring us that have these larger cities. And I don't think we have that. And in some ways, I think the current problems we face, they're symptoms of a much older problem. They're the result of processes that were set in motion a very long time ago to erode local culture, actually.
Yeah, this is why I find virtue ethics such a compelling framework for at least thinking about these questions. I don't really have too many answers besides try to do your best in every given situation. But if we see philosophy as the quest to figure out what makes a flourishing life, then I think virtue ethics is a really compelling way for ordinary people to think about that. And one of the most important reasons is I think that it rewards flexibility in particular situations instead of principles. So we see, whether it's in the cookie cutter developments or how to deal with them, this desire for neat abstract principles that just apply to places. And I love the idea in virtue ethics that you can't just cultivate one virtue and be done. You need all of them, and it's constantly a work in progress. And then they're all ordered by prudence. And it's only in the particular situation that the person or the community can apply these virtues to decide what's best. And I think it really does vary, even though we all face similar friends and foes. I think it really does depend. So I think that good people doing their best where they are, I think they can figure it out if they're even thinking about place in the first place. So I think a big first step is just, do I think about my place, what I mean to a place, and what a place means to me, instead of just, saying this is just a, I don't know, a remainder of whatever I'm doing with my work or my family, rather than a core part of who I am.
I think we have to become willing to accept the friction that I would say is built up in many good things. An example I like to use with my students is I say, I'm married, and being married is a restriction on my freedom, actually, right? Like, there's many things I can't do because I'm married, but it's worth it. And you find many things, the memberships that matter to us are ones that you can't just join an email list for and become a member. Maybe it's a church that has a fairly rigorous sort of expectation of its members and a process for becoming a member, or it's a community where you have to live there and sort of engage with the community in meaningful ways to become a member of the community. And we're lazy. I'm lazy too. My neighbor owns the bookstore in town, Circle City Books, I know Miles well, and he curates a wonderful used bookstore, and I often want to purchase books from him. I often purchase books on Amazon or Thrift Books,
He's going
right?
to listen to this.
Miles is probably going to listen to this, and
Sorry,
the
Miles.
problem is sometimes If it's a specific book that I'm looking for, Miles might not have it. If I tell him I'm looking for it, he'll keep an eye out. He might find a source, but it might be a while. And that is a cost. And it's, we ought not to downplay the advantages of, being able to purchase a book from Amazon and it arrives the next day. But if we're going to sustain local community, we are going to have to become increasingly willing to bear the costs that come with that increased friction.
Yeah, well, I agree. I agree 100%. I was thinking, of course, when prudence comes up, of course, prudence is the key virtue, right? The virtue of accommodating yourself to the actual character, so perceiving and then accommodating yourself to the actual character of the reality in front of you. That already requires that you are approaching it in a certain kind of spirit, and it strikes me that there's to go back, Matthew, you've mentioned Plato and others before. Thinking of Aristotle, something that I talk about with some of my students, that the development of one's character depends on the character of the community that one has. And we seem to be sort of trapped in the loop of saying place will be more valuable to all of us when each of us becomes the kind of person who attaches value to place. But of course, it's the community instructing us in what's valuable, in sort of forming us and shaping us, shaping, your children and mine. That gives us the orientation towards place as a value, the willingness to pay the price of the friction rather than seeking the frictionless life. Is this a chicken and egg problem where we don't really know how to begin the cycle except just by doing what we can do in our place right here, right now?
I think that sounds right because, I mean, as political theorists, we like to talk about on a community level, but at the end of the day, you're an individual or a family. And so if you're the chicken, there's really one option for you, which is to try to cultivate that where you are. That's my initial, maybe unsatisfactory answer there. I don't know what to think.
I think that's right. I think that's right. At some point, as an individual, you have to make some of these decisions, and maybe you start in very small ways. I've been very inspired by what Wendell Berry says about the productive household. I think there's something spiritually very valuable about being engaged in acts of production yourself and producing the things you consume. But we can't all live on farms. Human beings, clearly many of us are drawn to live in towns and in cities. And so we have to understand, like, well, the m many ways that we can engage in this type of production, it's not just growing food, but it could also be learning to play an instrument and entertaining yourself and your friends that way, or becoming a great storyteller, or like these are ways of producing the entertainment we consume. And these can start with very small things. Even if you want to become more involved in producing your own food, anyone can put a basil plant on a windowsill. And I think it is a good, very, very small step when you have that basil plant on your windowsill and you pluck the leaves from it when you make Italian food and you make a sandwich and you use that. Is that going to change the world? That single act, absolutely not. But it might change you in a very, very small way. And if many, many people take these little small steps that change their own character in subtle ways.
It's good.
That's progress.
Talk about Rousseau, then you're talking about progress. What do you
Just to press a little bit further, we'll move on to another point in a moment. I mean, it seems to me the danger here is that we become just hobbyists, right? That we sort of we're doing our own little sort of thing because the economics of our present situation permit us to do so as a kind of indulgence. But the people who would describe themselves as hard-bitten realists would say this is a kind of a luxury good that's maybe for the intellectuals of a certain disposition. Is there the possibility of, I'll ask again differently, would it be worthwhile to try to visualize what a 10-year or 20-year future would look like if place did take hold, if people were, if imagine if we won, do we have a clear vision or even a potential vision of what a better world would look like? Or are we in danger of just sort of puttering around in our own garden for the time that we remain
I
on
don't
this
know,
earth?
Matt.
What
I'm not
do
in
you
the
think?
business of winning. You take the question. I like to lose slowly.
Imagine if we won. This is one of the hardest questions, right?
Gotta take down all the looms.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure actually what it looks like in the long run. Because I am convinced that there's a real sense that some of these visions, just they're probably not recoverable. The United States of America is not going to return to an agrarian society on the mass scale, barring some sort of disaster. That's not going to happen. What there could be, like I said, is these small motions. Maybe some small local communities really do embrace a land ethic or embrace locality. I think there are places that have promise. I think Pittsboro has promise. I have trouble imagining a grander victory. But I think it's wrong to discount like the small victories. There's some if I'm a committed localist, it'd be very strange for my picture of victory to be some global account of flourishing. I want people to flourish in their localities. And then just to the point of hobbyist, there is a word that I hear used as a critique or as a negative that upsets me deeply when I hear it used as a negative. And that word is amateur or amateurish. Because what is an amateur? An amateur is someone who does it for love. And so when you tell me that my children's attempts at art are amateurish, like, well, yes, that's the point, and that's why I would rather have my children's art than most people's art. And I actually, saying we become hobbyists, I think in a sense downplays what I would actually love to see, which is a revitalization of genuine amateurism, where we do things for love. Whether this is art, whether this is writing, it's poetry. It's gardening, it's caring for our homes, it's caring for each other. I want us to do more things for love rather than for economic incentive. And in this sort of bleak technological moment, I think some people, I even see this with many of my students, are recognizing that there might be a point to that amateurism. AI tools can develop a more polished, a more apparently professional essay than they could ever write in this effortless, frictionless way. Many of them, unfortunately, right, succumb to that temptation. But some of them, I think, see how easy that is, and they recognize that there's actually something to take pride in when it comes to writing their own imperfect, flawed, sort of fleeting attempts at reason and sort of flailing through a text. I wouldn't say this is purely amateurish because they still hope to get a grade out of it, but that there's something beautiful in that.
Yeah, Matt and I sing from the same sheet of music here, so I just agree with that. Ever since he told me to move to Pittsburgh, I just listen to Matt. But he knows it's true. But No, I think that's very true. When I think about my own life, I get a little scared about changes coming, and changes how life works, unfortunately. And the reality is, life is pretty hard. When good things are happening, bad things are also happening. And I live in a really beautiful place, and it's beautiful right now. And I have a really good friend up the road, and I've got some chickens, and I've got some music, and life can be pretty good. So that's a huge win in my book. If more people could have a little bit of that, especially more people around here, I'd be really happy about that.
Yeah, I see the point. I think that's absolutely correct. I agree. I agree with all of that, and try to live it out in my own way, right here, in my place. It's in a sense, yeah. You've only got the time that you have, right, and the place that you have to do well. Maybe I can return to something, kind of a footnote in my mind from earlier. Matt, you said that you are, what did you say, ninth or 12th generation North Carolinian?
12.
It's pretty rare
12.
nowadays, in case you don't
Yeah,
know. A lot of folks
that's
moved to North Carolina.
thinking about the,
Like you?
well,
Yeah.
rare, but also not valued by everyone, and actually maybe kind of difficult to articulate the value of. We don't have, there's not a strong sense in America, certainly, of kind of inherited place of being. So when you're able to say, I'm the 8th, the 10th, the 12th generation of my family to live on this land or in this region, even in this county, it's rather unusual. And it feels, something like an inheritance that you've received. So you're maybe a steward of it in a sense, and you can hope to pass it on to your children. Does that become important to somebody in your position that there be a 13th generation of Youngs on in this area, on this land? How do you speak about that? How do you think about that, given what you've received? It's very easy to cut the thread, but it can only be passed on by people in your situation. I can't do that, right? I might hope my children are from my town, but I'm not. I only moved here, 2 decades ago.
Even in my own life, there's this sort of tension, I'm a 12th generation North Carolinian, but I wasn't born in North Carolina, actually. I was born in Louisiana, because that's where my dad worked in a paper mill at the time. And my dad grew up in South Carolina, though his mother had lived in North Carolina or was from North Carolina. And so my own personal connection has always been more broadly to the state or to the Carolinas than to the particular place. I'm the first, as far as I know, to have lived in Chatham County, though my grandmother tells me about how when she used to drive to the mountains, they would drive down Highway 64, and there was no 64 bypass at the time, and she would go around our courthouse. Our courthouse is located in a big circle, in a big roundabout,
We're known as the Circle City.
and so there are these connections, but right, there's this tension. I was in graduate school, I was applying for jobs, and I had geographic limitations, but I wasn't foolish enough to say I would only take a job in North Carolina. And so I had a lot of these conversations with my wife. She's from Kentucky, and her family roots are fairly deeply in southern Indiana and in southwest Ohio and Kentucky. And there was a cost to her that her children are not being raised in Kentucky, which was her home. But I get to raise my children in North Carolina, which I think of as my home. And we're in this act of, building a home together in a specific place, a specific town or a county that neither of us had a particularly deep connection to in that very particular sense. It does matter to me. And I hope my children live here. I hope they live near me. And I'm one of eight I'm one of eight kids, and all of my siblings are sort of scattered across central North Carolina. And I guess where I'm going with this, even in my childhood, my dad was in the military, then was working in the paper industry as that industry was being gutted by the economic and global events of the 1990s. Throughout the 1990s, my parents moved about every 2 years. And, they were in Florida, then California, then Louisiana, then two different locations in North Carolina. And I did not feel a particularly strong connection concretely to Smithfield, North Carolina, the place that I grew up, because that wasn't really my parents' place either, and so I think what I've been trying to do is take this very strong connection I feel to the state, to the region, and then narrow it down into a very visible, a very concrete connection to a specific location. And so, my property, so just this morning, we picked up a beech tree. This is the beech tree we're planting in front of the house. And beech trees are slow growing. And the beech tree we have is about 3 feet tall. And Camille and I were talking about how it's going to be a very long time before that's a big, beautiful beech tree. And it strikes me that when you live in a cookie cutter neighborhood with no attachment, you plan on or anticipate selling in a few years, there's no reason to plant a 3 foot tall beech tree in your front yard, because it's never going to be a big tree in your lifetime. But I'm hoping that 40 years from now, I'll be 70, about to be 71, and I'll sit on my front porch and have this marvelous beech tree in my yard.
Madeline, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think while I was thinking about this, just of particulars, this is kind of a deviation, but one of the cool things about the street where I live, which is my favorite street in Pittsburgh, Matt's is a close second, but not quite as good as mine. But I remember I was out on the porch one morning. It's my favorite thing to do, really early, when the sun was coming out when I first moved here. And I heard this sound in the woods that was a very intense sound. I was like, that can't be a dog. What is that? It was a roar, like a really fierce roar. And it happened over and over again. And it wasn't long before I found out that I live next to a tiger rescue, which is a legit rescue, by the way, North Carolina Tiger Rescue. This isn't some theme park. This is where, animals who are rescued from around the country go when they can't live in the wild anymore, and they're a great organization. And I learned that I live next to a pride of lions, and you could hear the male lions chuffing in the morning. His name is Roman, and every morning I hear Roman, and every evening he opens and closes the day like that. And just to think, I sit in the porch and listen to the lion. I love that. Now, unfortunately, Roman passed away a few months ago, and the lions kind of have gone silent. There's no other lion there who will chuff, and that kind of happening not too long after the magnolias just makes me very aware that nothing gold can stay, and that goes for every single thing in life on Earth, and just to enjoy it while you have it.
Yeah, I'm still kind of haunted by the story of those magnolias. The beech tree is great. The magnolias, I think I'm gonna kind of
Yeah. Nick Jones, one of my favorite folk singers. He's got a song called Green to Gray, kind of obscure, so I highly recommend it. And he's got a line in it. I think I mentioned it in my Cicero talk as well, which is all around this country they're changing green to gray. What grows up for a century, in a minute you can throw it away. That sticks with me.
Yeah, well, there is a kind of asymmetry, right? Of course, yeah, it's a lot of things have to go right. A lot of decisions have to be made correctly to have a long chain of, 12 generations in a single place. And, one decision that goes wrong can change it. I'm thinking here sort of maybe kind of wrapping up thought about our conversation so far. In a sense, all of us are kind of grappling towards a uniquely American way, and maybe even a sort of uniquely American late 20th, early 21st century way of being attached to place. Maybe I would say, I haven't researched this, but it seems to me at first glance that there's this long period of kind of homelessness or placelessness that rises in America from the mid 20th century, from post-World War II time, with rapid economic growth, ease of transit, etc., where people would be expected, not just academics, but other people, to travel frequently, to move across country, to be distant from their roots. And that after this kind of long period of rootlessness or placelessness, people are trying to put down roots again. But you need to have a new story to tell about that. It can't be the same as the old story. It can't be returning to the ancestral estate, the way you might think of in a novel set in Europe. Does that seem correct? Are we looking for a kind of 21st century American way of valuing and holding place and passing it on?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting way to think of it. I look at it as kind of the eternal question, but the details have changed on how one might go about that. I think what's important to recognize in place, Matt has a blessing of roots in this state. A lot of people don't have that, but that's not what place is about. We don't have to idealize. It's wonderful if you do have that. But I think valuing where you are is important, and I think we can easily think of a place where our ancestors are from, or returning as another type of utopia, because we still don't want to face the particulars of where we are. And I think that's a danger, because we're not talking about a nostalgia. That's easy to get that kind of critique, but the reality is I think a little more attention to place is good, and when you move away from that's not so good. So it's a scale. It's not an all or nothing thing. And every single one of us are in a physical place, in a body on Earth right now. And valuing where you are is important.
I'll return to the marriage analogy. When you see a couple that's been married for 50 years, at some point they were newlyweds, right? And sure, there's an advantage if you're born to parents who are committed and lodged in a place and have a community. But many of us don't have that opportunity. And again, right, it's not lost on me that 12 generations ago, a baker in my family tree, left their place where I'm sure they were, I think they were one generation removed, and their parents left a place that they probably belonged to for millennia, if not close to. And I think it's easy, especially with academics, right? This is the puzzle about talking about place with academics. Almost universally, academics are people who at some point were willing to make great sacrifices with regards to leaving a place, or make sacrifices with their family or their convictions for the sake of a career and, a vocation. And so, of course, it's oftentimes puzzling, especially in sort of mainstream academia. If you talk about place, if you talk about religion, you're talking to people who have very little frame of reference for these as being significant, substantial things that matter, even at a place like Ciceronian, where we're predisposed to caring about this, right? I think what I would say, right, is if you're without a place, if you're rootless, you can always start becoming rooted. The old saying is that the best time to plant a tree is 50 years ago, and the next best time is today. And I'm doing a lot of planting trees today on my
Making
property.
up for those magnolias.
We're not all lucky enough to inherit a property full of trees, and we're not all inherit lucky enough to inherit deep roots, but what we can do is start putting down those deep roots today.
That's great. That's a fantastic insight. I was thinking as you're talking that there is a certain kind of built-in distortion to the fact that our academic class, our intellectual class, is full of academics who have this filter, sort of place filtering out filter applied to their training and their at least their early careers. That's certainly been the case for me as well. Let me wrap up. As beautiful as that was, as a principle statement, let me wrap up by returning to the particular, to Chatham County and to Pittsburgh. What's one last thing you guys would like to share about this place and what you love about it?
Christine Miller or owns the feed store. She's passed it on to her son Josh Miller, but Christine and David, who are also my landlords, they're wonderful people in the community, and Miles's bookstore. And then what else we you know we're actually a tourist destination back in the day because we have a well back when well tourism springs excuse me springs were a thing. It's owned by like George Washington's son or something. You remember that? What's that?
Yeah, I can't remember the
You get to choose between health and
statistic.
beauty if you come.
Yeah, no, I think this is just a beautiful place to belong, and I love the little road I live on. That Miles, who owns the bookstore, is on my road, and there's a lovely little outbuilding on my property. It's really the only lovely outbuilding, but Miles built it
Very well made.
actually
30 years ago.
about 30 years ago, and when the property was owned not by the person before me, but by a member of the family who owned the entire large farm that was subdivided into these smaller properties. And I have other neighbors, my neighbor Robin just down the hill, and Ann and David, and many of them are not originally from here, but they are doing everything they can to create a little center of gravity, right? That sort of can help hold soil in place, and can help hold people or attract people to that place.
That's marvelous. Thank you very much. It's beautiful thought, beautiful images, and sort of again the particular, the embodied and place for us to conclude with. I want to thank both of my guests, Madeline and Matthew, for being with me today on The Sower. You've been listening to The Sower, the flagship podcast of the Ciceronian Society. If you enjoyed this episode, please like, subscribe, and tell your friends about it. Join us next week for a new episode. On behalf of the Society, thank you for listening.